This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
I've done it in Ladakh, I've done it in Goa, I've done it in Bangladesh.
When I leave this country and come back, I just feel like I cannot make any sense out of this culture.
The British and Europeans generally have a view of Americans as being kind of bovine.
I did it in Vietnam, which is especially sweet because Uncle Sam sent me a letter when I was 18 that essentially said, here boy, take this gun and kill those yellow people.
You know, the greatest destruction on the earth is happening at the hands of peoples with PhDs.
I wasn't sure whether I was conceived as a last ditch of despair or the first ray of hope.
And I met one guy, and he had no legs. And when he was 17, 18, he was drafted in the South Vietnamese military, and I ended up helping him out, getting doctor bills, that sort of thing.
So, yes, this is Hitchhiking Off the Map from our cubbyhole in Sebastopol, California, which in many ways is way off the map.
And that is Conrad Bishop, and this is Elizabeth Fuller.
At the controls.
What controls?
Control yourself. No, you need some controls here. You know, you realize I am actually older than the President of the United States, and he has all the controls.
Where's the off switch?
Well, now, you know, that, of course, was one of those gratuitous comments that demonstrate how thoroughly the nation's media is dominated by left-wing radicals. Yes, friends, we do have a stranglehold on ourselves.
In the spirit of bipartisanship, I'll shut up.
Well, we're putting this together not too long after a certain election, and obviously we feel grouchy because, to be perfectly honest, our team did not win. In fact, they barely even showed up on the field. But in the spirit of unity, we would like to dedicate a moment here to the two-thirds of the registered American electorate who sat this election out. Here are your voices. We thank you, and the President thanks you.
So today we have two stories. They're about responsibility, human responsibility, civic responsibility, or the lack thereof. The first, Mark Gold.
Mark Gold had, well, in some ways, a fairly normal childhood, if we were completely honest about what a normal childhood is for a lot of people. Preparation for life.
Well, I grew up in Atlantic City, New Jersey. My father was a city photographer. Like, he worked at the nightclub, the 500 Club, run by the Mafia, where Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis got together, and Sinatra would come there, And I started working when I was like 7, selling newspapers, going into whorehouses and to bars and hotels. And it really, when Atlantic City was in its heyday, I knew I wanted to get out and travel. When I was 14, I told my parents that the Scouts were having another weekend up at Lake Lenape, but they weren't. And I got on a bus and just spent the weekend in New York City and came back and didn't tell them until I was 40. And then I wrote a newspaper column when I was a freshman in high school, but then LSD and the hippies and the Beatles and John Kennedy and everything went from black and white to color, and I had a choice between LSD and algebra in high school, so algebra had to wait. And so I came out to California. So I lived in a commune, and I got a job with the landscape gardener. And after 30 minutes of digging ditches, I decided to go to college, even though I hadn't finished high school.
Between then and now, Mark has made many journeys, way too many to tell at one go. He became a school teacher, got married, was teacher of the year in Manhattan in 1977, back to California to grad school at Berkeley, medical psychology, worked with cancer patients, then heroin addicts, then the first cases of AIDS, and administered a huge project. Finally burned out at that, started teaching at community colleges, and that's what he does now, part of the year.
Well, basically, Jewish kid from New Jersey, how I got interested in India and Tibet, I really can't tell you. When I was 7, I had this dream that I'm standing on Mount Everest in T-shirts and short pants. And somewhere where Andhra Pradesh would be was a village, and there was a man with a turban and a wife with a sari and a little boy and a little girl looking at me with their hands gesturing like, come, come. So I woke up and I told my father, And I said, Dad, I'm going to India. He said, are you nuts? It's expensive to fly then, you know? He said, Indiana, forget India. I said, no, I'm going to go. So he said, okay, you can go, but if you go, you have to do a mitzvah, which is a Jewish word, which means a good deed. I said, what am I going to do for these people? He said, you figure it out when you're a man. So he died when I was 14, and I kept this interest in India. And then finally, I got divorced in the mid-80s, and shortly, about a year after that, I really fell in love with a girl, a German girl. And after a couple of years, she went back to Germany, and I went into the biggest depression of my life for about a year. And almost to the day, I had that same dream. I mean, really, the same Mount Everest and all that. So I said to myself, okay, Mark Gold, you can't have what you want, number one. How about number two? And I had this image of going around the world as a kind of healing thing. You know, I like dramatic, you know, no going around the block for me.
He was between jobs. The kids were with their mother. He started around the world, Hong Kong, Calcutta, Darjeeling. And out of the fog, literally, he met a Tibetan who took him to visit a painter of silk.
So off we went in the darkness of these steep streets to really a slum. And there was this corrugated tin shack, and he knocks on the door. And, you know, here you knock on the door, someone doesn't know you. It's like, yes, what do you want? There it's like, it's almost like they're expecting you. Oh, please come in and offer you something to drink. And there was this very nice young man named Tinna Gyatso and his wife and three-year-old boy and parents. And he was a fantastic painter and a great guy, and we became good friends. And I noticed his wife would cock her head kind of funny when people would talk. And he said she has some terrible hearing problem. You know, these people were living on $600 a year. So I went to the post office, and well, there was one phone book in the town, but I found an ear, nose, and throat retired professor of medicine 3 hours down the mountain. So we went down there, and he announced that she had a raging infection in both ears and that she could easily die if left untreated, which it would have been. And he said, only one problem. I said, what's the problem? He said, well, we can fix it, we can cure it with an antibiotic in each ear 3 times a day for a week, but it's 50 rupees. That's just about $1.25. I said, no, we can overcome this problem, you know. So that saved her life, $1.25. And then it said doctor visit, 100 rupees, sliding scale. So I pulled out a 100 rupee note, which is less than $2.50, and he refused to take it. He said, I cannot. You're my first American patient. I said, but I'm not the patient. She is. He said, no, I love three great Americans, Mr. Abraham Lincoln. I said, okay, he's great. Mr. Martin Luther King. I said, okay, he's great. And Mr. Michael Jackson. A funny trio. Anyway, so then he said, the right ear she won't hear from anymore, but the left ear is only half gone. If she gets a hearing aid, she'll hear it nicely. So off we went down the street, and there was a shop. Hearing aid was about $55. When she heard what that was in rupees, she said, don't do it. Forget it. It's not worth it. It would be like if I told you you need a hearing aid, 50 grand, you know? So we kind of argued about it until I finally insisted. And he put the hearing aid on her, and I reached over, and I flipped that little switch. Well, you know, these Tibetans, they have beautiful faces anyway with the high cheekbones. But if you could see God in that moment, that was it, man. The tear went down her eye. She said, I can hear. You know, and the kid was crying, the street traffic. And I looked at her and I thought of what my father said. So then my wheel started turning. And this is 1990. And the next time I went in 92, I sent a letter to 100 people. It's a nice round number. And it just said, it was to my friends, my relatives, my favorite waiter. And I said, look, I'm going to India. They're really poor. $400 a year is the average income. So I said, you want to send me a dollar on up? Feel great about it, you know. If not, don't worry about it. I thought I would get $200-$300, put in $100 myself. I could do something. Well, I got $2,200. And I proceeded to go to orphanages and Mother Teresa centers and meeting people on the street. And I went all over India, and it blew my mind. It was the most fun and the most interesting, and things happened that would never happen to tourists. And a lot happened, a lot. And we gave it all away, and we documented it, and I wrote a little newsletter. And I thought, I don't know if I'll ever get here again. This is my second time. Well, I've been there 6 times now, and I've given away now almost $19,000. It's not Bill Gates, but one person can do something. I pay my own expenses. I just take out for the cost of the you know, the mailing and the newsletter and all that sort of thing. Of course, I'm not standing on the corner announcing and handing out rupee notes. Some of it's random, you know. Like, I met a guy in a hotel. His father had a very bad broken leg, and they set it very poorly. So we just paid to have the father come and have it reset, and, you know, it was $40, you know. Another guy we met was going to die of tuberculosis, father of three children in Delhi, because he didn't have the money for the medicine, which is an outright cure. You take it for 9 months. So that was about $50, $60. And then we put him in business the rest of his life. And we went to a warehouse a few blocks away, and we bought pens and pencils and chocolates and Indian bidi cigarettes and notepads and miscellaneous stuff. And you can get a lot for that amount of money. And he started putting it out in front of his little hut. And people in the neighborhood came by. Oh, look, let me get a pencil. He paid 2 rupees. He sold it for 3. You know, that sort of thing. And I met him a couple years later, and he was cured and looking good, and kids were in school. And he had two shops. A child care center for the children of the sex workers. And these kids used to just hang out in the bordello. You know, not the best place for little guys. And so we made a donation there. And I mean, Bill Gates. Once I was in Lucknow, and there was this little girl, and she had meningitis, and she was in high fever, and she was panting and sweating. And so I asked the mother through his translation if I could approach the little girl, and she said yes. And kind of reached down, and in my bag I had a little magic wand with the little sprinkles in it and the water, you know. And I pulled it out, and I put it in her hand, and all of a sudden she stopped panting, and this big smile and little teeth, and she grabbed it, you know, and squeezed my hand, and the doctor, he really got a kick out of it. And he came to my hotel a couple days later, and he said, "She's better a lot sooner than we thought." And we theorized that this guy was taking me. And while I was on the rickshaw, the wheel fell off and it broke down. And the guy was practically in tears. He lives in this thing. It's his bread and butter. And so I found someone who spoke Hindi and English. The carpenter, and he said, "I went to this medical supply store, and he's been trying to sell this machine for 2 years. He sold it for $450 US. So we took some pictures, and then they put the first two babies under it with a little eye mask because it's too bright. And he said it's going to save 200 to 300 babies a year. That's a buck and a half a life. So that's one example. I said, "What do they need?" He said, "Blankets, Kashmiri blankets." So we were at the marketplace in Leh, the capital, and he said, "Please, Mr. Mark, don't be offended, but if you go with me and we buy these blankets, we'll pay 5 times the price. Stand on the side and watch, you know." So we went.
Okay.
He got the idea. And by the way, a lot of times when we give the money, if we give a guy on the street, let's say 1,000 rupees, 20-some dollars, sometimes they'll say, "Well, what can I do for you?" And what we usually say, whether they say that or not, is take a small portion of this and find somebody else who really needs it. You know, whether they do it or not, I don't know, but they always look very delighted because it kind of fits in and it gives them some dignity as well. I'm a realist. I'm a very practical person. If I look at all the problems of the world, I wouldn't be able to leave my bed, okay? So what I figure is, from the point of view of all the problems of the world, what I do is so infinitesimally small as to be completely meaningless. However, if I look at the individuals who actually get the help for that particular person, he's not saying, "What about the other billion people?" He's saying, "Wow, thanks a lot. I got bus fare to go back home to my parents," or "Thanks a lot. My kid can go to school this year," or "Thanks a lot. We can get that asthma medicine." What I picked up from my father was, don't end your life with the feeling that it didn't matter that you lived. Certain things I'm absolutely sure of. You know, if I go to the Mother Teresa Center in the slums of Calcutta, I'm just willing to bet money that they're not going to buy cocaine and go to Vegas. I mean, most of these people are so poor. I'm sure some of them have given it to their parents and they bought whiskey, you know. I'm sure it's happened. But all I can say is I'm vigilant and I've gotten very experienced. And I feel very confident that a very large percentage of our money goes to a good cause. You know, I love to follow my nose. I've been in lots of places where I was the only foreigner there. I've been in places where they never saw a foreigner. And sometimes I literally wander. I think I'll take that alley and I've never been stabbed or robbed or attacked, or even now, like there's civil war going on in Nepal, and I asked my friend who knows the area quite well, and he's been here, and I said, "How's Nepal?" And he said, "Not as bad as Oakland."
Okay, Mark, so what happens when somebody listens to this and calls and says, "Hey, this is great. Can you use $1 million?"
Oh, I can deal with that. As much as I like counseling and teaching, I would like to do this full time. And I would have a little office, and I would go out 3-4 times a year. You know, when the Cold War ended, people say, "Oh, what's America's mission now? What's America's mission now?" I was like, duh. The planet is in huge trouble environmentally. The haves and the have-nots is going to produce unbelievable problems. The population is out of control. And you're looking for a mission? You don't have to look too hard. So that would not be a problem. I've been accused of doing this because it makes me feel good. I accept that. Yes, it makes me feel good. I like to feel good. I'm, you know, like that tough. The people who are getting the help could care less what my motivation is. So I just do it because, to me, it's the most basic human. I mean, there's not a lot of things I know for sure. But one thing I do know for sure, and I don't see how anybody could deny this, and that is there is great suffering in this world. And if your response is to ignore it or want to make it worse, that's fine. My response is that when I see another human being who has red blood like me and cries like me and laughs like me and, you know, like gets hungry like me, I just can't imagine any other response, you know. And so let those people say and do it as they would. You know, every day you open up the papers and it's like, oh my God, well, quit flapping your lips and do something. It's my attitude, you know. For me, it's an existential must. I have to do this. To do nothing, to look at all the problems of the world and reach the end of your life. "Hey, Grandpa, what did you do about the environment and the starvation and the illiteracy and the poverty and the crime and the violence?" "Oh, nothing. I just watched the 49ers and drank a lot of beer and kept the door closed." To me, it's no answer, you know.
In Richmond, California, we were talking with Mark Gould. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And if you have a story to tell, we'd like to hear about it. It doesn't have to be India. It might be a journey across the street or down the block. But what were the challenges, the turning points, accidents that got you to wherever the hell you are now?
Email us through our website a few words about your story and we'll get back to you. The website is www.independenteye.org.
Well, this question of reaching out, some would say, well, that's just a feel-good thing, or it's none of my business, it's just contributing to the problem of hunger to feed anyone. And on the world scene, where does the humanitarian response to genocide or despotism cross very slowly over into nation building? And where does that become, oh, well, we're back to imperialism. How about that? Hello.
Well, there's a really legitimate distrust of altruism in that just about everything, including mom and apple pie, can be diverted into political manipulation. But I still believe in action in the here and now. It's probably better to help the person with the broken leg right now than to wait for the revolution or the second coming.
Another story of responsibility. This is Watchers.
Hon, what's the weather like? Why don't you jog outside?
It's supposed to snow.
Ooh, what if the car doesn't start?
Well, we'd save on gas.
It's a blizzard out there.
Granny, that's the TV.
TV's over there.
No.
Well, I can't see. These glasses, ever since I got these glasses, I can't see.
You can see.
I can't see.
Look, we take care of you. The doctor prescribed those glasses. The doctor knows if you can see.
I couldn't see the doctor.
Is that the Johnsons?
Wish they'd keep their window closed.
It's tic-tac-toe. I'm gonna scooch my chair up closer. Oh, no. It's one of those horrible, violent things. I wish they wouldn't show that.
She's worse than kids.
Well, she wants to go to a rest home.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to put my mother in a home. People have to take responsibility.
But she isn't happy here.
She'll be happy whether she likes it or not.
I never seen the like. That poor woman. And what if those children saw that, what they're doing on
Look,
there?
Granny, that is not the TV. That is a window. That is a woman out there at... Oh, my God.
It's awful what they have on there.
Honey.
What?
They've got that woman and they're... Oh, my God.
Honey.
Right outside our window.
Oh, the window's closed.
We can't let them get away with that. A lot of people stand around and let them get away with that, but we will not stand around and let them get away with that.
We'll take responsibility.
A good idea. We'll call the cops, because the cops have got sophisticated computer communications, and they'll be on the scene in seconds. Now, I'll do the dialing. You get the description. No, you do the dialing. Won't the kids be proud? No, I'll do the dialing.
Call the police.
What's the number?
Find a pencil.
Call the cops. See, the cops, because they can't get away with this. Crime, inflation, radiation.
It's horrible.
H for horrible.
I can't find a pencil.
Is that the girl was on Johnny Carson?
Granny,
I thought she was cute.
That is the window.
Well, I can't see. You're just a big white gob. My only son is a big white gob.
We have to take charge. Some people sit behind their four walls with their family and wait for the blizzard, but when you get the chance to reach out and create positive social change...
I miss Arthur Godfrey.
Dial information. No, they charge for that.
Oh, our phone bill last month.
Get the description. Oh, yeah. How many are there?
1, 2, 3, 4... No, she doesn't count.
What'd she look like? They put you on the witness stand, you have to be precise or the defense attorney will rip you to pieces.
I'm trying.
Phone book. 1, 2, 3, 4. She doesn't count, but she does count because she's the human being, and we gotta call it ambulance.
I'm trying.
Fix your hair.
Why?
You're a witness, you gotta look neat so they believe you.
I don't have anything to wear.
Phone book. What? Come on, what do they look like?
Oh, there's one black.
Black? He must be underprivileged.
One with a leather jacket.
What?
He's white.
White? He must be a young punk. One black, one punk. What about the third guy?
What's the commotion?
See for yourself.
I can't see.
No, that's right. We're all blind to reality. We don't see the writing on the wall.
I told them not to scribble, but you said the magic marker would wash off and you're the daddy.
No, we look in the papers. We look out for number one. We look through our rose-colored glasses right into the teeth of the blizzard.
I could see better with my cataracts.
Come on, the third guy. We gotta see the third guy, because we're not gonna stand around. There he is, there he is, there he is. He hasn't got any clothes on.
They'll know him right away.
That's no description. Look at his moles. They always have moles. Fix your hair.
Find a pencil.
Make a list.
Look at his moles.
Call the police. Okay, white, black, no clothes, naked, leather jacket, girl. Operator, give me the police. What?
It's starting to snow. She'll be in the snow. She'll freeze in the snow while we sit in here warm and comfortable, and she'll freeze in the snow. Where's the paper?
Weather report. Find the paper.
Fix your hair.
Find a pencil.
Make a list.
Look at his moles.
Call the police.
Call the police. 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 It's the police! I called the police! I really called the police! Okay. Police? Yeah. Here it is. You get this. White, black, no clothes, naked, leather jacket. Girl! Thank God.
I'm gonna see what else is on.
Are you okay?
Oh, tired. I mean, boy, there were three of them.
I'm so proud of you.
Oh, honey, for once in our life.
But, honey, it makes me think.
Oh, it's good. It's really good.
But why is it that we're more concerned about strangers than about us?
Oh, no, it's for us. It's for us.
All this unbridled energy. When have we felt this way? Together.
Oh, but honey.
We've lost touch. I read the paper, you jog. We yell at the kids. We clean up Granny. How long has it been?
Oh, honey, I hear you calling to me. It's like a sudden fanfare. What right do we have to reach out and meddle in the world until we put our own lives in order? Oh, honey, let's not meddle in other people's lives. Let's meddle in our own.
Things happen for a reason. It's a blessing in disguise.
I wish we could afford cable. I could almost see better without these glasses. I'm just gonna take them right off. There's a dead woman out there.
We'll close the curtains.
I wish they'd have more comedy.
That was Watchers, written by Bishop and Fuller, and we were joined by our longtime colleague Camilla Shade as Granny. Our engineer was John Yule.
Who really lives in Pennsylvania, but whom I just saw recently out here at a reunion of a bunch of friends who had all survived working at National Public Radio. Hello, John.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is a production of The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the contributing members of the Hitchhikers Guild. You can become a member, you can listen to past shows, you can give us some very welcome response, you can get gift CDs and tapes, and you can procrastinate from whatever you're really supposed to be doing, all on our website, www.independenteye.org.
Next up, three women's journeys from Siberia to Australia and back to the reservation. We'll be talking to Dina, Galina, and Demira.
And a few more credits. Our webmaster, Steve Willite, web facilitators, Stephen Powell and Eli Bishop, our trade association, AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, a bunch of snaggly and extremely generous and wonderful people. Finally, house-sitting during our travels by Sunshine and Lucia, and our neighbor Meg feeding our feral cats.
That is Conrad Bishop.
And that is Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
I have an Australian friend. I asked him if he had any hints before I went to India the first time, and he said, I'll give you the bloody key. Now, when you're there, no matter what happens, it's okay. If you stand in line for a train ticket for 2 hours and they shut it in front of your face going to lunch, don't get mad. Just say fine. It was great being in a train station. Or if your food doesn't come for an hour and a half, whatever it is. Because Hinduism and Buddhism is all about letting go. And when I come back to America, I can keep that for about 2 weeks. And then it's, where's the damn website? And when's the light going to change? But there, the expectations are different.